Hello, I'm Keith Powell, and welcome to Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. This Wednesday, a tragic event happened at WDBJ, the CBS affiliate in Roanoke, Virginia.
To provide a better experience, we're saying tourism. We want the people that come here to say that was...
To the shock of many viewers of the morning show on WDBJ, reporter Allison Parker and photographer Adam Ward were shot dead by an assailant live on television. This happened at around 6:45 a.m. It wasn't long after that Jeff Marks, the general manager of WDBJ, went on air with this sad announcement.
We are following breaking news this morning out of Franklin County, news that has affected our WDBJ7 family very deeply. Our WDBJ7 morning crew was live this morning at Smith Mountain Lake when shots were fired around 6:45. And our general manager and WDBJ7 Vice President Jeff Marks is here. To tell us more about what happened.
Kim, it is my very, very sad duty to report that we have determined through the help of the police and our own employees that Allison and Adam died this morning shortly after 6:45 when the shots rang out. We do not know the motive. We do not know who the suspect or who the killer is. We do know that the Franklin County Sheriff, I just got off the phone with Franklin County Sheriff Overton. I just got off the phone before that with the state police. They are working very diligently to track down both the motive and the person responsible for this terrible crime against two fine journalists. I cannot tell you how much they were loved, Allison and Adam, by the WDBJ 7 team. They both were in love, and we'll talk about that a little more, with other members of the team here, and our hearts are broken, and our sympathies go to the entire staff here, but also the parents and family of Adam Ward and Allison Parker, who were just out doing their job today, covering a story near Smith Mountain Lake. Yeah. And what was the name of the plaza, Kim?
Bridgewater Plaza.
Yeah. Yeah. And we'll tell you more as we can, but we have other members of the team here with us today, holding back tears, frankly. Kim has been working with Allison and Adam for quite a while. Mm-hmm. So has Leo Hirschbrunner, our morning meteorologist. Gene Jadhon is the co-anchor with Chris Hurst, and Chris has said it's okay to say that he and Allison were an item. Mm-hmm. and involved. Chris is here and quite devastated, as is Melissa Ott, who was engaged to Adam. Melissa was our morning producer and a part of this team.
Actually, Melissa's last morning producing our show, and we were celebrating that with her earlier today. And, you know, Allison had brought in balloons. I had brought in a cake. It was a day of celebration. It was just an ordinary day. You know, we were so happy for them. You know, she had gotten another job, and Adam was going to follow her soon after, and they were going to get married. And, you know, there were a lot of good things, you know, happening for Adam and Allison. Oh, wow. She's a rock star, you know, here at WDBJ. She really has done a wonderful job reporting, filling in, anchoring. You know, you throw anything at that girl and she could do it. We just came off this the child abuse special Monday night, and she was just a huge, huge part of that, really, and just came off like a pro.
When this happened, many people were asking, who would do something like this? Well, it happened to be a disgruntled former employee of the Virginia TV station who stalked and ambushed the news reporters during a live interview Wednesday morning. In fact, after he fled the scene, he started to upload video and photographs that he had taken when he had shot the two journalists dead. Vesterly Flanagan, who was 41, worked at the television station from March 2012 to February 2013. Many people at WDBJ said he was a very unhappy man, and the reporter, even though he had some talent, had a very difficult time working with the staff, and whenever he could, he would take offense at anything that was said. Many of the staff at the television station, this angered him, especially when he was fired, And when he was dismissed from the station, he had to be escorted from the building by police. He even filed a lawsuit against the station for wrongful dismissal. And this wasn't the first time. In 2000, he tried to sue TV station WTWC in Tallahassee, Florida, for discrimination and retaliation. The case was dismissed. Also, just before this happened, he had sent an over 20-page fax to ABC News. The content of the fax has still not been made public, even though parts have been released, clearly showing a very disturbed individual. After he fled the scene, police eventually caught up with him, where he did attempt to take his own life. He eventually did die from the wounds inflicted by the gun. According to ABC News, a 23-page fax was sent to the network. It arrived almost 2 hours after the shooting. It came from someone who identified himself as Bryce Williams, the on-air name of the gunman. In the message, according to ABC, the gunman said the Charleston, South Carolina church shooting in June is what put him over the edge. But what he wrote is that he was angry, and it was steadily building because of racial and sexual harassment he claimed to have endured. As I mentioned a moment ago, the television camera that was used wasn't the only one rolling. Two videos posted on Twitter under the name Bryce Williams Show, someone walking up to WDBJ news crew, pointing a gun at them, and then firing. The Facebook and Twitter account have been suspended shortly after the tweets, but have started making circulation through various other social media sites. Kelly Zuber is the news director at WDBJ. This is what she told me.
So basically, you know, it was, you've probably been to our website, WDBJ7.com. It was a former employee. Well, everyone, as you can imagine, is very distraught, but, you know, everyone is trying to stay strong. Do what those two individuals would want us to do.
As this story is ongoing, when we do get more information on it, we will bring it to you. You're listening to Media Network Plus, coming to you from PCJ Radio International.
The Spectrum Monitor is a monthly electronic magazine covering shortwave, amateur radio, scanning, satellites, Wi-Fi, and vintage radio, which is available for any device capable of opening a PDF file.
Category 105, which is speed to 22 journals.
Speed to 20, Category 105.
The Spectrum Monitor also covers amateur radio satellites, maritime and military monitoring on shortwave, reviews of receivers, scanners, and software used for shortwave, and more. Annual subscriptions for 12 issues is only $24, with individual monthly issues available for $3 each. If you're already a subscriber, you can renew your subscription by clicking on the Sign Up for 2015 button. MasterCard, Visa, Discover, and PayPal are accepted. For more details, visit our website at www.thespectrummonitor.com.
Now to a story that we talked about on the program previously. Anybody who's paying attention to media in the UK knew of something called the Leveson Inquiry. This was looking into the phone hacking scandal that shut down News of the World and rocked the corridors of News Corp. But has anything really changed? Well, to find out if anything has changed, Richard Adie speaks to Stephen Barnett. He's a professor of communications at the University of Westminster in the UK.
There have been several convictions in terms of bribery, not on the journalism side, but on the public official side. So you've had prison officers, civil servants, etc., now serving jail terms because they handed stuff over which was regarded as neither in the public interest nor legal. So it's been, there have been convictions, and that's only, I think it's important to say, that's only amongst News Corp. That's the Murdoch operation. It is now absolutely clear that much the same thing was going on in the Mirror Group newspapers. That in the UK is this sort of left-of-centre equivalent of Murdoch's tabloid operation, possibly on a grander scale. And there are the Crown Prosecution Service is now considering whether and whom to prosecute, and they are already in the process of settling civil claims, very large civil claims for damages for people who they have admitted hacking into.
So a number of people have already been arrested, including the last one just a couple of weeks ago, I think. At the Mirror.
That's right, yeah. I'm not sure the exact number. I think at the moment it's only two or three. But certainly the word on the street is it's going to go up and it may well go higher.
Now, these allegations, I think, Stephen, they predate the Leveson inquiry, don't they? We're going back perhaps 10 years.
Oh, absolutely. It's suggested now that it actually started in 1999. So it was the very beginning of mobile phones, really, when someone somewhere realised that you could get quite easily into people's voicemails when they hadn't reset their own private PIN. And the peak was probably around 03, 04, and it was certainly going on through much of the 2000s.
So that led to the Leveson inquiry, which began just over 4 years ago, and the report went to government 2.5 years ago. What's the upshot in terms of press regulation?
Well, when he first asked Leveson to do his report, what Cameron said, what the Prime Minister said was, if it's not bonkers, I'll implement it. When, as you say, he delivered it in November 2012, he started to backtrack. And under huge pressure from our national publishers, not just the Murdoch Press, but there are three or four other powerful publishers in the UK, was very wary about implementing those proposals, which included a proposal for a backstop regulator. By backstop, I mean something that's set in statute, which would oversee a voluntary regulation system. So the principle of Leveson is self-regulation continues, but you have a protective backstop body just looking over the shoulder of that self-regulator to make sure they are actually doing what they say they're going to do. That's the principle. And Cameron backed down from that backstop proposal, under, as I say, under huge pressure. So where we are now, those major publishers who were the ones who were actually at the root of the phone hacking, not just phone hacking, but quite a lot of other dodgy journalistic stuff that went on as well, they have all said, we're not going anywhere near the Leveson structure. They've essentially put two fingers up to the whole system and said, we're going to carry on with our own self-regulator.
This is IPSO, isn't it?
This is IPSO, exactly. Independent Press Standards Organisation. Yeah.
I was on their website just a short time ago.
Yeah.
And it says, we uphold the highest standards of journalism by monitoring and maintaining standards set out in the editor's code of practice. You don't have to read for long to read other people saying this is the toughest regulator in the Western world. Stephen, what's wrong with it?
Well, the people who say it's the toughest regulation in the Western world are usually those people who are employed by or are actually on the board of IPSO. In other words, it's the national publishers themselves who are parroting that line. There's a very simple answer to the question, what's wrong with it? It is paid for and run by the very news publishers who say that it is an effective and independent system. So, essentially, you've got the prisoners running the prison.
But you've got a very well-respected Sir Alan Moses, retired appeal court judge. Yep. He is chair, and he's the noises he's made is that, you know, he's not happy and he wants change, and nobody doubts his intentions or his probity.
No one doubts his integrity. You're absolutely right, and he's made lots of noises, and absolutely nothing has happened. No material change has emerged of those that he has said, and you have to ask why a respected High Court judge would actually take that job on without saying, I will only do it on the basis of the changes that I insist are made first. I don't doubt his good intentions. My own sense of it, and I've been looking at this area for 30 years now, is that he had no idea about the power that those publishers can exert.
And this comes to the heart of it, because this is IPSO, everybody's heard of it. It's you know, widely enough known in the UK now. But it's actually controlled by an organisation that funds it, the Regulatory Funding Company, which almost nobody has heard of, and that is in turn controlled by News UK, Associated Newspapers, of which the Daily Mail is the best known, the Telegraph and the Mirror Groups.
Exactly.
So it's essentially Fleet Street, the long arm of Fleet Street, controlling the regulator which regulates them.
That is exactly right, and yet it carries on insisting that it is independent, and it bandies around this word independent in the hope that if they say it enough times, people will believe it.
Have they proved any of the doubters wrong? They must have considered cases so far. They've been going now long enough for investigations to have come up. How have they gone?
It's a patchy record. There are certainly one or two cases where they have said, yes, you must publish an apology. What you said was wrong, it was inaccurate, or it breached the code. There is only one case that I can think of so far where they have said that the apology that you published in 8 point at the bottom of page 72 is not sufficient for the front page splash that was the original story. That is one, as you can imagine, that is one of the victims' great complaints, that actually apologies bear no relation in terms of size or scope to the original story. But they've only done that once, and frankly, there is no indication that that is going to get better or to increase.
But despite all this, Stephen, you are actually, you have some optimism about self-regulation, don't you?
I'm optimistic because there is another system. One of the legacies of Leveson is that what Parliament did do was it passed a structure that was similar to what Leveson actually recommended, which is there is now a, rather than Act of Parliament, there's a charter which is there to set up a body that can recognise self-regulators according to the criteria laid down by Leveson. And those criteria are genuinely tougher than those that apply to IPSO.
So, post-Leveson, do you believe that we now have a change in how journalism is done in the UK?
I think that is actually the key question. I think you put your finger on the core question. And at the moment, I think the answer is maybe a little bit, but as they famously said about the French Revolution, it could be too soon to tell. The other issue here is that after any major scandal or obvious breach of journalistic standard like that, and we had it in the early 1990s, there is always a period of 2 or 3 years of retrenchment where the big papers think, okay, we went too far there, we'd better row back a bit, let it all quieten down, and then we can start up again.
That was Stephen Barnett, Professor of Communications at the University of Westminster in the UK, and he was speaking there with Richard Adie. Now, how many of you have heard the expression, the more things change, the more they stay the same? You've heard features that we've done in the past about clandestine broadcasting around the world, even here in Asia. Now, this is actually not something new. And surprisingly, if you take a report done in the 1980s, you can actually run it today and just make a few slight changes. Well, we went into the archives and found a report from around, almost 30 years ago. Here's Roger Broadbent and Jonathan Marks.
Perhaps the most famous during World War II was Tokyo Rose, which in fact wasn't one particular person, but a number of Japanese female announcers who broadcast to American GIs. The Rose philosophy has now been taken a stage further. In fact, there are two of them at present in the Far East shouting to opposite camps across a 100-mile-wide stretch of water. The soft sell propaganda campaign is between the People's Republic of China and Taiwan. Both countries have been broadcasting to each other to explain the benefits of each other's particular system for many years, but it's only relatively recently that they've resorted to the soft, sexy female voice technique. What's even more curious in this particular situation is that both female voices have identified themselves. Whereas in the past, such schemes have always relied on the fact that the identity of the female has been a mystery. Eight times a day, transmitters in the People's Republic of China broadcast a 15-minute program on an average of 11 frequencies towards Taiwan. The voice is that of 42-year-old Miss Su Man, and her program is simply called Friends on the Air. Neither strident nor dogmatic, Miss Su is the embodiment of peaceful reunification, the voice of maternal persuasion. This is in direct contrast to the hostile, self-righteous propaganda of a few years ago, when announcers simply read the People's Daily editorials and lectured Taiwanese about the glories of communism and the fact that Taiwan should be reunified with the mainland. In a recent interview with Western journalists, Ms. Su explained that there are no threats in her broadcast to liberate Taiwan. "We simply want to quietly dispel Kuomintang rumors and set the record straight. The papers in Taiwan are still printing stories that we need a permit to leave our houses and that each person has 1 inch of cloth ration to them each month." Despite the fact that Miss Su's listeners in Taiwan run the risk of penalties for listening, which range up to a term in prison, it appears that enough letters get through for Miss Su to run a style of mailbag program. One Taiwan listener wrote to Miss Su to ask if, after reunification with the mainland, would Taiwanese need cooking oil and cotton coupons to live on Taiwan? The answer broadcast back, of course, was no. Taiwan can maintain its present lifestyle. Her refrain is China's 9-point plan for peaceful reunification, which claims that Taiwan can retain its capitalism, its armed forces, and its relatively unrestricted way of life. Politics is, of course, interwoven into the Chinese fairy tales about the Moon Festival. There's also advice about treating stomach cancer with herbal medicines, and even interviews with former Kuomintang officers who've defected to the Chinese mainland. It would appear that the authorities in the People's Republic are pleased with Miss Su's performance, for on October the 1st, the National Day in the People's Republic, the daily broadcasts to Taiwan were increased from 21 to nearly 38 hours, with programs in Hakka and Minnan dialects spoken in Taiwan often running in parallel. And because the distance between the two countries is so small, a balloon campaign was recently organized to drop leaflets on Taiwan with the program times for the Friends on the Air broadcast. In fact, there are no direct mail links between the two countries, so Miss Su advises her listeners to write through a box number at any Chinese diplomatic post. Since the start of this soft sell approach, over 400 letters have got through to the studios in Peking, ranging from inquiries from profit-minded Taiwanese businessmen to family requests from Chinese on Taiwan who wish to make contact with other members of their family on the mainland. So, for the moment, tourism and business are the major themes in the broadcasts.
This is the Voice of Free China, Taipei, Taiwan.
The Broadcasting Corporation of China, that's the Republic of China, based in Taipei, has its counterpart, although unlike mainland China's Miss Su, she hasn't yet talked to the press about her work. But on October 31st, when a mainland Chinese Air Force pilot defected to Taiwan, newspapers in Taipei printed a picture of their female propaganda voice, who it seems is known as the Rose. Underneath the picture was a statement from the defecting pilot saying that his decision to defect had been influenced by Radio Taiwan broadcasts. The Rose has been credited so far with persuading 7 Chinese pilots to defect to Taiwan. Both sides use shortwave and medium wave to reach their target audience, and both sides are guilty of jamming each other's soft clandestine voice. In fact, the People's Republic of China stopped jamming Taiwanese broadcasts at the beginning of August this year, but it was resumed again on October the 4th.
Meanwhile in Japan, Hideharu Tori has released results via the Japanese Association of DXs of direction-finding measurements from 2 other unofficial radio stations. The first is known as Radio Sparks, and its first broadcast coincided with the start of the so-called Great Cultural Revolution in China. The station also calls itself the Voice of the Liberation Army, or the Proletarian Battle Division. But listening to its contents, it's quite clear that the broadcasts do not come from mainland China itself. And for many years, it has been assumed that the Soviet Union has been behind the program production. This also applies to Radio 81, which began broadcasting in March 1979 in the midst of the Sino-Vietnamese War. Several times a day, the station transmits Chinese language programs of about 5 minutes in duration between 12 and 1530 hours UTC on the frequency of 12120 kHz. In fact, activity of this station has been somewhat erratic recently. Using the facilities of NHK's Foreign Broadcast Monitoring Post in central Honshu, Hideharu Tori has done some direction finding. The survey this time has indicated that Radio Sparks is located somewhere in the direction of 250 degrees from the receiving site in central Japan, while Radio 81 is in the direction of 325 degrees. From this, Tori draws the conclusion that Radio Sparks may be emanating from a ship in the eastern China Sea, and that Radio 81 appears to be broadcasting from a site near Vladivostok on the east coast of the Soviet Union.
While it's true that perhaps the style today may have changed, but they still continue to do the same thing. That was Jonathan Marks and Roger Broadbent. Well, let's now take a look at propagation and what's been happening and what we can expect. Here's Glenn Hauser.
Keith, the global HF propagation forecast from IPS in Australia through August 29th, normal to fair. Space Weather South Africa calls for unsettled to active magnetic conditions on August 28th. Shortwave fadeouts unlikely. MUF unstable through August 29th. The four-day space weather forecast summary through August 29th from Met Office UK. Solar activity with a 60% chance of further isolated moderate class flares and associated R1 to R2 radio blackouts. But the risk of minor storm conditions is considered low. Peter Coleman, OK1MGW of the Czech Propagation Interest Group, says the geomagnetic field will be quiet to active August 27th and 28th, September 2nd to 4th and 16th. Quiet to unsettled August 29th and 30th, September 12th to 15th. Mostly quiet on August 31st, September 1st, 5th to 8th and 11th. Active to disturb September 3rd. Quiet on September 9th and 10th. The outlook from SWPC in Boulder, unsettled to active geomagnetic levels expected through August 29th, also September 2nd, 4th to 6th, 12th to 14th, 16th and 27th, due to recurrent coronal hole high-speed stream influences. G1 minor field activity is also expected on September 3rd, ANKNSEs peaking at 25 and 5. Quiet to unsettled levels expected for the remainder. Lowest indices of 5 and 2 on August 30th to September 1st and 7th to 11th. Solar flux declining from a peak of 125 on August 28th to 85 on September 11th, up to 105 by September 14th. Bill Hepburn's VHF-UHF-DX maps call for extreme tropospheric ducting over the western and eastern Mediterranean from August 28th, along the southeastern Brazilian coast from August 30th. Off Baja California, especially the morning of August 31st, and all week around the Arabian Peninsula.
And that's all we have time for. Have a pleasant weekend. 73 and 88 to the ladies.